Let's just hit this tower there. That's it. Oh, yeah. Okay. Hello.
Not on. Okay. All right. Thank you so much. I would like to bring the Boulder Planning Commission meeting, work meeting, to order. Can I have a roll call? It's October 19th.
John Brantley here.
John Brandt here. Colleen Thompson here. Nancy Tosta here. Okay. And we have Jen in the audience. Jen Villal. Tina Carlson and Jen Bach. It's so blank that. Sorry.
And Peg and Lee and Michael Wynn.
And Peg and Lee and Michael Wynn. Yeah, right. Okay, great. So all recorded. So tonight is a work meeting, and I'd like to state that what I am hoping to get, you know, from all of us is some input on what Lee has given us and what we want to highlight as options we want to move forward on. So we do have a map of the the road. Oh, you printed it out. Wow.
It's so small.
Oh, that Peg will bring up, which is...
It's hard to bring up. I can't bring up the whole thing. I don't think
is it that one? No, it's the map is of the streets that are considered our C road fund streets.
You know what? I'm not even on here. Keep talking.
And they're highlighted in red, and it was on our list of materials for tonight's meeting. I just think we might want to refer to it in regards to some of the possible requirements we want to look at, or options for defining the roads we're using. And I'm going to start with that. I'm going to start with road access. I'd like, before Lee starts on this, if any of us have any comments on his the materials that the draft he did on the road, Boulder access standards, basically any of the access standards that he talked about. So, but can we start with the Boulder access standards and see if we have any thoughts about what was presented? Does this seem like a good way, a place to start? Does that?
Yeah.
Yeah. Okay.
So I did notice on Lee has two basic principles, number one and number two. And then the next number one is where he proposes that the town adopt a street map into its general plan. And I think that's something that we should really look at the beginning. I think we're trying, Peg's bringing that map up.
You've got your choice of the street standards or the road. What do you want that up first?
I think, go ahead and maybe we could look at the map, first of all, so everybody's...
Okay, there should be...
I think it's at the end of that list.
Okay, so this is a map of the Boulder's Class C streets.
So and what is the difference between the blue and the red, Nancy, on that map? Does it say on your map?
Yeah, there's a key at the bottom.
Yeah, but there's no color legend. Oh, yeah, there is. Okay, gravel roads versus paved roads versus dirt. Dirt roads are yellow, gravel are red, and paved are blue.
Oh, yeah. Oh yeah, paved.
Paved or blue. So The Lower Boulder Road is blue. Obviously, Highway 12 is blue. I believe the streets around the town hall are blue. Can you bring that down a bit?
And you can blow it up, Peg. I mean, when I look at it, I can make it bigger.
So here we are.
The Lower Boulder section, the Bird Trail going down to, I guess, basically, it's within the town limits, just below my house. And then up through town, there's the street that crosses, or the back road is on there. The road into the town center is on there, and all the way around to the highway again.
So this is kind of town center area right in here, right?
Right. And then there's a blue road that's up above, and I assume that is the cemetery, but I don't believe that's paved.
Right here?
Is that the cemetery?
Can you see my widow?
North? Yeah.
I think that's Judy Davis's road, I'm pretty sure, that goes up to Connie Reed's house.
Judy Davis's road is a private driveway, and it does not go up to Connie Reed's house. It's the one that goes just north of the hotel, and it goes up to Connie Reed's. It also accesses the brim. But anyway.
Are we talking about this
one? Yeah.
Yeah.
Oh. Okay. Yeah, Tina?
Yeah.
The one I think you're talking about is labeled 500 North?
Yes.
That is the road past Judy Davis's. And then the one showed in red is a platted town road that goes up through the Brems property.
The back road on the Brems property.
And that was the big fight last.
Yeah, that's
was the Brems wanting to pave that.
There's one other red road that is,
Tank Road?
Tank Road, which I'm not really aware of, but that again, gravel road. There's a couple gravel roads going.
Tank Road must go to a tank.
Yeah, goes up Upper Boulder, and then it's a gravel roads. It looks like paved roads through the subdivision.
So, is this little trail Tank Road thing? Is that past the cemetery? Is that?
Yeah. Yeah, that's the one past the cemetery and up to the tank and to Mark Austin's property.
Right. And then we go
right, which I think ends basically not at his property, but at the tanks. Yeah.
Yeah.
And passes the cemetery.
And then this other blue part, that's Boulder King Estates.
Yes, correct.
Got it. Okay.
So that's the map we have so far. And, basically everything else is considered private.
Could I correct that, Tina?
Or except for the roads that haven't been opened up by the town.
Yes, exactly.
Sorry.
Yeah.
Anyway.
And do we know what those roads are that haven't been opened up by the town?
I can't go. I mean, there's a few of them, but it's a platted map right downtown area that haven't been opened. Andy's opening one of them, and
right.
Let's see, west of the road. The highway. Anyway, it might actually be on there. But this is our working map at this time.
And I think, as Lee said, that we should make a plan to adopt this into the general plan. Because it's that way we would know what those roads are. And he was saying, I mean, it really is a frustration that this isn't made more public, as far as our meetings and and things, as far as that goes.
And I think in doing this too, I think we probably need to indicate all of the private roads, all of the other access that is established at this time in the process of planning for future development. But that would be my. What does yellow mean? Yellow.
Yellow. I mean, scroll down.
Dirt. Okay. There's also dirt. Dirt versus gravel versus chip sealed, really, basically.
Yeah.
And those are our road surfaces at this time.
So the only other thing I was going to say is that Lee has on this paper three definitions of public street, and private driveway, and then the standards, and that he listed for those as far as kind of definitions, which I thought was extremely helpful.
Sorry.
Thank you, Lee.
Which paper are you looking at?
The access, the Boulder access streets. And that's where I also found that he suggested that we adopt the street map into the general plan.
Now, do you want me to bring up this access document right now or stay on the streets?
Do we all have, does anybody need that on the screen? Michael, maybe.
Streets?
Yeah. It's hard to read from here on the screen, so I'm using my computer at this point.
Well, I haven't made it through.
Oh, well.
Tina, I'd like to make a couple of comments on that map before we move on.
I'm sorry.
Yeah, I'd let everyone else speak first, then I'll go last.
Okay. Okay, so was that pretty much your...
Yeah, that's...
Okay.
Thank you. I don't have any comments on the map, but I do have some questions on the access.
Okay, great. So go ahead on the map, John.
Okay, so just to summarize for everyone's benefit, that map is showing what we are getting. I would consider those the roads that are being maintained with public funds. There are some interesting omissions, like the road to the dump, which is outside Boulder town limits, which is probably why it's not shown. As the big one, as we just mentioned, or Tina mentioned, there are a large number of roads in the town center, what they called on the plats called Boulder town site, where there are platted roads that have never been opened up by the town and are not currently being maintained. So we're not taking credit for those on the claiming for Class C road money, but are in fact town owned. So that is a major addition for planning purposes that probably should be included.
Which ones are those again, John?
What?
The undeveloped town streets.
There are town streets in the center of town that are platted that have never been opened up and maintained by the town.
But you feel that the dump road, which is not in the town, has actually been maintained by the town?
Well, good question. It might be excluded because it's in the county, and I don't know if the county is maintaining it. I'm just pointing out that that's an omission. The main point I'm making is it is a good map, but we need to understand Jones and DeMille prepared that for a specific purpose. And I'm just pointing out that there are some omissions. The map does show in light all the other roads that you do see on Google Earth. You know, 1600 South, which we've been talking about, that's the one that goes to Sean Owens. The Anson Road there is shown. So it does show in light without highlight color most of the other roads if you look carefully at the map. But so there are, so it does have a lot of the other roads since it's based on aerial photography. But the big omission for planning purposes is that there are town-owned property roads that are not shown that we just shouldn't be forgetting are there.
Right. So I think that, you know, this is a good place for us to start with as a map, and then we need to define the rest of the roads, in my opinion. So for our purposes, mainly too, but, you know, so that we are defining all of the roads that exist in Boulder. And that in that defining, I think that we can move on to those questions on definitions, if we have any, or comments on definitions of access roads. Was that one of your questions, Nancy?
Well, one of my questions, you want to get into the questions?
Yeah, sure.
So I had a question on the first basic principle. There must be legal recorded access to every subdivision and every lot within a subdivision from an existing public street or highway. So that's not true, right? I mean, right now, because there are subdivisions that are accessed via private roads.
Right, and I think it goes on to to acknowledge those two, but maybe I missed that. Lee, do you want to respond to that?
I do, and this takes us back to the importance of the map and being sure as we can that the map is complete. It's incumbent on a developer, on a subdivider, to show that those people to whom he or she is selling a lot have legal access all the way to some place where they have guaranteed public access. And so there are cases in Boulder now where that is not as clear as it ought to be. And of course, what we're doing here is not retroactive. It does no go, does not require people to immediately hop to and fix the past. What we're really saying here is that if you create a new subdivision, then it's your responsibility to show how people can get to a public way. That may be via a private street that already exists. It may be through an easement that already exists. It may be on a street that you as the subdivider build. There are some different ways that this happens, but really the problems that we have seen consistently come from ignoring this basic principle. And if the subdivider is required to make good on this, then they may have to negotiate with another landowner. They may have to make investments. The subdivision could turn out to be impractical for that reason. But I think that the town is, I don't think the town wants the liability of approving lots that people can't get to, is I think the simplest sentence I can say.
Great. Okay, go ahead,
Lee. I think my question about it, when I read it, it makes it sound like you have to have access directly to a public street or highway. Maybe you, rather than using the word from, you could say every lot within a subdivision to an existing public street or highway, which may be via a private street. I mean, because it just, you know, when you look at all the private streets, I mean, Anson's 1600 South, Muse Lane, I mean, these are all private streets, and parcels are accessed via those. Ultimately, yes, you get to Lower Boulder Road, but it's not direct access from a lot to a public road. So it was just confusing to me because it sort of sounded like that's what you were suggesting.
I think we could clarify that. What I don't want to do is give the impression that a subdivider is going to be allowed to proceed if they can't show how this works. So that, you know, that's the general principle that's underneath the general principle. And I will take what you've said into account here and see if we can clarify that. Sometimes I really feel like it would be best and easiest if we could give examples. But the way these things end up having to be hammered out ultimately into ordinance form, we have to try to come up with some sort of a clear statement of principle without using examples. But I hear what you're saying and understand that there could be a bit of confusion there.
Yeah, I'm just going to put a comment in here right now on this, in that I think that the goal here is to figure out where we all agree or have an understanding of the basics on how we're going to move forward here. Like, access definitely is important. How we state that we'll kind of hash out when we get there. The other part of this, I believe, was the definition of roads, is that correct? Private driveways, road standards. Does anybody have any comments on how, I guess I'd like to start with the definitions of, I mean, how are we defining roads? And Lee obviously has set up here private driveways, private streets, and public roads. I think it's what you say, private streets?
Public streets. They're all streets.
Yeah.
In order to make this, I use the word streets to make it a little more formal, because hey, there's roads all over Boulder, right? All you have to do is look at that aerial photograph, and you can drive a lot of places. So I've chosen to use the word streets to distinguish it from the, shall we say, informal network of other ways that are out there. Streets have in this conception of things, streets have a legal status, some type of legal status that a road does not necessarily have. And we can fiddle with the language if you want to, but I felt like it was important to have some clarity there. So that's why I used street throughout here.
Okay.
It's April. Currently in the ordinance, we only have streets. We do not have roads in the ordinance.
Right.
But it seems like we also talk about roads a lot, but streets. Right. Okay, so we're going to work with streets, and I'll agree with that. Any other comments?
This is John. I think the big one we should discuss tonight is eliminating the idea of a private driveway to four lots. I think Lee is probably correct, because the original language in the ordinance that we revised in 22 was the town has considerable discretion with private driveways serving fewer than four lots. And what that meant, it was very unclear. It would make sense to me to say that both private driveways and private streets have to meet the fire code access standard if it serves more than one lot. What that would mean is that a private driveway is the access to one lot, and private streets is anything else that meets fire code standard. And I'd like to throw that out as a topic for discussion.
If I may follow on, I think John is suggesting the right direction for the discussion here. The driveway thing was confusing, or has been confusing, ever since 2018 when I started looking at it, and has resulted, I think, in some decisions that maybe could be rethought if that were possible. The place where John and I may diverge is in talking about private streets. It's pretty much standard practice by most jurisdictions, and we all know that Boulder is not most jurisdictions, but I want to start here. Most jurisdictions require a private street to be built to the same standards as a public street. And John will point out that that's a very expensive decision, and maybe one that is not compatible with the do-it-yourself subdivider in Boulder. What I've put in here to try to give us a way to work with the difference is to suggest that the street standards be tiered, and that a lesser standard be applied for eight or fewer lots, and an engineering standard apply past eight lots. And obviously my choice of the number eight is somewhat arbitrary, although in Boulder, an eight lot subdivision is a big subdivision. So that's where we should start. But I think the first thing that I would like to hear, and I think this is what John was trying to say, from the Planning Commission is whatever people have to say about confining the definition of driveway to a driveway that serves one lot. And we're not going to string four lots onto a driveway easement. And if the idea of confining it to a single lot is not acceptable, then we need to have a conversation about that. If people are okay with saying, okay, one driveway, one lot, then we can move on.
Do you have any comments on that?
I think that makes sense. So I think that makes sense. It's not the definition we sent to the town council, the private street. This notion of meeting town standards, I think, is something we need to talk about. Private street. On the private driveway standard, just a private drive, the first one under private driveway standards, Lee, a private driveway may serve only one lot that does not abut a public or private street. Serving more than more lots will require a private street. I think there are lots that, you know, the driveway comes into the lot, but the lot abuts the private street. So I wasn't sure why it can't abut a private or a public street.
There's a semantic thing there, and that's a good question. We've been thinking about private driveways in the context of them serving a lot that's not connected to the street system in the subdivision. And that's what the language, whatever it actually means, in the existing ordinance was about. And this probably needs to be tinkered with so that in the odd case that the driveway comes through another parcel to a lot that has an unusable frontage on a public or private street, that we could handle that. And I think that's not too hard to change, but it's a good question to make sure that we're accommodating all the possibilities.
And I was wondering about the 90 degree requirement. I mean, it seems like often a driveway may come off at a slight angle, you know, 75 degrees, or I mean, it's not a T intersection in every situation.
Or it can even possibly be a T in some situations.
Right. But it doesn't have to be 90 degrees. I think there are a lot of driveways that aren't.
Well, there are a lot of driveways that aren't, but the question is, what's a good practice? And you will have to root deep and deep and deep to find an engineering standard that doesn't want intersections to be at more or less 90 degrees for safety reasons. And from my perspective, I'm not going to start you off with a standard that is out of, you know, way out of best practices.
We could say should in a second.
When possible. That's always a good one.
My guess is that anybody who's actually trying can meet the 90 degree standard. It's just sometimes that it's a little more convenient or cheaper to not meet it. John, you have a thought?
A couple things. Just to address what Nancy's first remark about driveways. There are really two parts, and I suggest one is going to have to be in subdivision, and the other one really probably needs to be in building code. That we have adopted by reference the Utah Wildland Urban Interface Fire Code. That requires a vehicle access, which they actually use driveway in that case, within 150 feet of the building. So that would be not a subdivision standard, but something we need to make clear in our building code regulations, that as part of getting a building permit, you have to provide fire access to wherever you put the building on the lot. So I just wanted to mention that. As far as, you know, the look and appearance, Lee and I have both struggled with this, that the standards you look at tend to be very urban. So like the site distance, the 90 degrees, but we're talking about vehicles, these driveways here in Boulder, outside of the Boulder King Estates subdivision, typically are half a dozen vehicles a day. You're talking one vehicle an hour type traffic levels. So adapting a traffic standard that's appropriate to hundreds of vehicles per hour, one or more a minute, isn't Boulder. So I think that's a general plan vision type thing. You know, do we want to insist on suburban type 90 degree intersections, Or do we want the more rural Y intersections that you see that people kind of cut the corner with the trucks? That's kind of the look and feel of Boulder, but I have no strong feelings. I'll let the community decide that. But I would like to kind of come to closure on the question here. Do we basically agree that if you've got more than one lot, it really isn't, we've agonized in Meadowlark over four lots versus six lots, depending on what happens in that area in the future, that's not the right distinction. It's either serving one lot or it's serving multiple lots. And if it's serving multiple lots, it has to meet the fire code as a fire access road. Can we agree on that?
I think, can I go ahead? I think that I would prefer to think of it as it is in our building standards that each building, the road into each building, which would be a driveway, would have some way to maneuver the fire truck around, depending on how long the driveway is. And the streets, I mean, if we're looking at, let's just give an example of the one we've been looking at for quite a while here, where there's five lots. There's one, two, three, four lots that they wanted to call the street a private driveway. But each one of those lots will have a private driveway to their homes, which will require whatever needs to be required for the fire department. So I'd like to suggest that, as Lee said earlier, that our standard is that each lot, you know, the building permit will require some kind of fire safety road situation, and so will, and it will also be required in the streets themselves for the fire truck to get to where it needs to be. I don't know if that's any different than what you were talking about, John, but that it seems a little different.
I think it's consistent, is that each of those parcels is going to have a driveway, and that's going to be the case in virtually any subdivision I can imagine. But those driveways are going to connect not to a public road, but to a private way. And that we have to decide what standard that's going to meet. And we need to talk about that, but I kind of would like to reinforce what John asked and say, hey, are we okay with one driveway, one lot as a principle? And if we are, then we can move on. And we can talk about whether driveways need to intersect at 85 degrees or not. But we need the principle of one driveway, one lot to clarify what we've been dealing with from the past. When it's not clear. And if the Planning Commission is clear on that, that, from my point of view, is progress.
I'm good with that.
I am too. So I think it's a good start.
So if in fact someone decides to share a driveway with another person because they're, you know, sharing the cost of that development, that driveway then would become a street. Is that what you're, a private street? Correct. I mean, is that right?
Yeah. No, that's, if it serves more than one lot, it would become a private street. Okay. Now we can imagine two people having a side by side point of access where they decide to share the cost of building a driveway. But in fact, as long as it remains a private driveway, and as long as it meets the standards of serving both lots, which is to say, basically, as long as the fire department approves it, then they could do that. That would be, from my perspective, outside the town's concerns and jurisdiction. I think that, you know, that might happen once in a very great while. The real concern is to no longer string four lots along a narrow private easement. and hope that that works.
Right. But I mean, not to get semantics here, but so if we say that, if we all agree, or we, this is our option, or the one that we were pushing for, is that each lot has a driveway, but once it's more than one lot using it, a street or road or whatever, that street becomes a public street. I mean, a private street, sorry.
A private street in most cases, yeah.
I would say the more important distinction, Tina, is that we'd stop making a distinction between whether it's four lots or six lots.
For a private street, I agree.
That's where we've gotten hung up in the past. And I'm saying, when I look at the fire code, the requirements don't change. So why not just say that if it's a private street, it doesn't matter how many lots it's serving.
I agree with that.
Two, four, six, eight, it's all the same.
More than one.
More than one.
More than right. One.
Okay. Okay, let's go with that one. Okay, so what the definition we'd like to go to present to the rest of the Planning Commission, how we're going forward, is that a driveway is for one lot, and any road that accesses more than one lot would become a private street, if not dedicated as a public street. But basically.
Mm-hmm. That's okay. The gist of it.
Okay.
And then you have to ask yourself, if you want to apply any of these standards to the driveways, or if you want to just go with whatever the fire department will accept. I will say, and I guess this is as good a point at the meeting as any to say, that I have spent an awful lot of my life sitting in either a county or a town office with people who built roads cheap and informal and find that they don't work and are now demanding that the county commissioners or the town fathers and mothers accept that road for public maintenance and fix it. And that is really when you see me being formal here, that's what I'm trying to avoid, is for liabilities to come back on the town. And by meeting a few relatively straightforward and simple standards, I think you avoid a great deal of that potential liability.
I know when we're talking about this, it's as we're talking about this, I'm trying to envision these standards and things that we're talking about in the future as we continue to develop, not we, but as the land continues to be developed here. Like, I think that's when you're talking about, you know, what you just said, that description, I'm looking at certain lots and subdivisions already in town and thinking about that as far as not what we have right now, but the future, and actually looking at what we have right now, some of the roads that aren't great roads, especially when they get washed out, you know, here because of the nature of the sand that they're on in the slick rock, and what we can do to make that better in the future, because there'll be more people traveling on it.
Mm-hmm.
So I totally understand what they're saying here right now for the future.
Uh-huh. Oh yeah, Elizabeth, please. I'm Elizabeth as our planning liaison.
Hi, I just start to say thank you, and I appreciate your all's dedication and communication. Because we are using the wilderness, Urban Wildlife Urban Interface Code already, that we've adopted it as a town, and you've referenced it for the fire apparatus turnarounds. I believe, and we should double check that the code states that a private driveway serves five dwellings, but doesn't distinguish lots. So instead it's distinguishing dwellings. And so for consistency, if we've already adopted that, is it necessary to have our own separate definition is something you all could look at?
It's a good question. And I would say it's absolutely necessary to have a town definition, because five being one more than four is an even bigger problem to sort out amongst landowners who in the future may end up not agreeing with each other about the fate of that driveway, and who will show up at town hall saying, hey, why don't you guys fix this? You approved it. Got to remember that the town's signature is on these. And that implies some responsibility. You have to decide what level of responsibility. I'm trying to give you the most basic definition of that responsibility that I can imagine. But you do have some responsibility to a consumer who buys a lot, or who buys one from someone who bought one, and we're 15 years out. You have some responsibility that that person will be well served by what the town approved. But I mean, and I keep telling you, subdivision lot lines are forever. And John has pointed out to me quite appropriately that roads can be upgraded. He's absolutely right about that. But roads last a long time and have a big impact on the landscape. So it's not as if we're making a decision that only has to hold up well for a month. We're making a decision that has to hold up well for years. And again, I'm happy to just erase all this stuff if that's what the Planning Commission wants to do. But I want you to think about the consequences before you do that.
Okay. So can I just ask the point that Elizabeth raised? So dwellings are really different than lots, obviously. And, you know, you could have multiple dwellings on one lot. You know, in theory, I mean, you can have an ADU, you can have the main dwelling.
You have an ADU.
You know, can you have five dwellings on one lot in Boulder? I don't, probably not.
Not yet.
And not according to our code. Do five dwellings exist on some lots in Boulder? Yes, they may. But it is a sort of a completely different way of thinking about it than the lots, the way we're sort of approaching this. So I'm trying to get my head around it right now. I mean, if we've already adopted the Wildland Interface Code, we don't want to put something in place that contradicts that, obviously.
Are we constrained by that? I mean, that's how I kind of feel.
You're not constrained by the Wildland Code. You can add and make things more stringent. The point that's raised there that dwellings and lots are different is absolutely true. Good point. But up front, when you as a planning commissioner are looking at a subdivision, you probably don't know how many dwellings. Will there be an ADU or will there not? You don't know. What we're stuck with, for better or for worse, and sometimes it may not be for the better, but what we're stuck with is what we can see, and what we can see is lots.
Right. So when we deal with the fire, we're dealing with the fire code, let me just say it that way. We are dealing with it twice in our code as it is now. It's when someone subdivides, and it's when someone builds a house or puts a and it basically is, can a fire truck get close enough to take care of any kind of fire issue? So that's the two things. Anyway, that's what we have in code, which I hope that's what we keep. And because we can't have more than two dwellings right now, we can always revamp that if, in fact, we need to say something different. But I mean, the fire code does not allow us or allow someone to do more than it is required or is allowed within the ordinances, which is not five dwellings per lot at this point. So anyway, okay, so where are we here? I think we all have agreed that private driveways, one streets, anything over one lot, and what's the next thing?
I would like to suggest that you skip these driveway standards and think about them in light of both what John said about the practicalities of it and what I've said about the future consequences of it, because there's no one right or wrong way to balance those considerations, right? You have to decide if you're going to really let Boulder be Boulder, then you can have an intersection that comes in at an oblique angle. And presume that there's so little traffic that it's not a problem. I'm simply giving you what I think is a minimum to address the most common concerns. And I certainly would suggest that you keep the drainage part of that, because you don't want to drive a new driveway being simply bulldozed across the borrow pit of a public or private street and blocking the drainage. Beyond the drainage, if you want to drop the others, fine. But I'd suggest that we set those, because they're relatively straightforward and easy, aside and talk about private streets. And I will say here, you know, that between what John has suggested and what I have written here, you have two pretty different choices to talk about. And I'm going with what we normally go with, which is that a private street is going to be owned and maintained by the owners until they convince the town to take it over, which happens on a pretty regular basis, and therefore needs to be to town standards. And John is saying, no, that's not what's happened in Boulder. It would be pretty expensive, and I understand that. I think there does have to be a maintenance agreement, even if it's just a track through the brush. Somebody has to, you have to know how someone maintains it. And I sent you guys a bunch of links to different maintenance agreements, including one that was written for a subdivision in Boulder. It's not very hard to assemble a model maintenance agreement that will hold up and be useful to people. So I don't know that we need to spend a great deal of time on that now, but I do think the philosophical question, or policy question, if you prefer, about private streets, it would be really good to at least have some discussion and maybe even some sort of tentative resolution on that, because this makes a big difference.
Yeah. Lee, could I make a few comments on that? Sure. I think we're not that far apart. Peg, or whoever's moderating, could you give me permission to share a screen so I could bring up something that a drawing?
You have it. You can do. I'll stop the share. Wait a minute. Oh my God. Okay.
Yeah. Okay. Share screen. Okay. Share.
Okay. There we go.
Okay. We can enlarge that a little bit and resume it. Okay, so I kind of picking up off Elizabeth's question, when I start actually reading the Wildland Fire Code, there isn't a lot of difference between they really have two things. They call a driveway, and their other term is a fire access road. And there isn't a lot of difference, but there are some problems. One of the problems, as they say, an all-weather road without any further guidance of what that means. And as we discuss, if we get to it later on, SB 174, the old approach of having the fire authority go out there and look at the site and say, yeah, that's okay or not, really isn't going to work within the framework of that bill. Because our any comment, the law says we must cite a specific drawing code standard, whatever. So I think we need some, this drawing that I've just brought up is something I prepared borrowing very heavily from a Kane County road cross section, which was prepared by Jones and DeMille to kind of to get the pedigree. That we need, this is what I would, and I've also taken input from Sam Stout, who's built an awful lot of driveways here in Boulder. And this is sort of what I would say would meet the minimums of being a private driveway that's an all-weather road. If you're on sand, you need to put down some pit run gravel and some compacted road base. Probably if you're on slick rock, you can get by with gravel or road base on top to smooth out the roughness of the rock, but we would not need to do subgrade preparation. You need some sort of crown. You need some sort of drainage ditch. You need some sort of shoulder. The fire code requires a clear width of 20 feet. I think that we could interpret that as being a 12 feet of good gravel and 4 feet of shoulder on each side. I think we have to decide how wide we need the right-of-ways to be. Our current ordinance has 40 feet, and I left that. County roads typically are 66 feet. I have seen some 32-foot right-of-way. So that's one of those numbers that we certainly have a lot of ability to adjust up or down depending on our needs. But something like this, it protects, if we have a drawing like this in our standards, it also makes the fire authority's job much easier because it's not totally arbitrary what he calls an all-weather road, and there can't be accusations of, well, you required him to do this, but you're requiring me to do more and so forth. So I think there's going to be a lot of benefit. If this was a fire access road, it's going to be essentially the same thing, although my reading, you might need to, on a driveway, you're allowed up to 150 feet. You can do single lane with turnouts. On a fire access road, you need the width that two vehicles can pass. Pete has mentioned very importantly that that's a concern, because if people arrive early at the fire and park along the road, and then the fire truck arrives, it's got to get past the people who arrived ahead of it. So I think having enough width that you can park and you can pass a parked vehicle is important. This is sort of typical. This is probably at the high end of what people have been building in Boulder as driveways. But I think it's reasonable and defensible. I ran some numbers. This type of road would cost you about $20 a foot with current Boulder earthwork and fill material prices.
Can you repeat that cost, please?
About $20 a foot.
$20 a foot?
20?
Yeah, 20, 20.
And are you talking driveway or street?
Yeah, I'm confused.
Well, this would meet the standard of a private. This was what I would recommend as a private street meeting the minimum of the fire code.
Private street, but not private driveway.
Well, right now, I looked at a lot of ordinances. San Juan County, for example, explicitly says we don't set any standards on private driveways.
Right, right.
If you need to have four-wheel drive to get up your driveway in the winter, that's your problem. That's their attitude.
Right. I just want to clarify that, John, because you keep saying private driveway, is standard for private.
It is actually about what I built. This is very close to what Sam Stout built for me as my driveway.
Right, but we wouldn't require that.
This would be a private street. It's a private street meeting the minimum of the fire code.
Now, can I hop in here?
Yeah, sure.
First of all, I want to say something to the rest of the PC. About the effort that John put into this. If Jones and DeMille had drawn this, the town would be getting a bill for a couple of grand. And I really respect the effort that John has put in here. I think that the biggest point that John made, and it may not have popped out, is the state requires us to have standards like this going forward with SB 174. There isn't any reasonable way around that. But even more important than that, from my point of view, is the ability of the town to say that it's fairly administering its ordinances. And the point John made is, okay, if we don't have something like this, then how do we determine that the fire department made Joe do what Jack didn't necessarily have to do? We need something like this just as a basic principle of fairness. In my opinion, this could be a little narrower and still meet the test of a fire truck passing a parked vehicle. Most of the Forest Service roads like this are 18 feet rather than 20. And that might save the builder a smidgen. So I don't know that the exact numbers here are beyond discussion, but the nature of the surface, the nature of the grading, a road that doesn't have a crown is a road that is not going to last. That's maybe the most fundamental thing of all this. And so I really appreciate what John did here and suggest that this would not be a bad starting place for talking about private streets. I think that driveways that debouch off of this could be narrower. I think that the San Juan County, if you have to use four-wheel drive is great until you try to get the fire truck up. I went to a public meeting once. This was in Ohio. I was working in rural Ohio down in the Appalachian part of Ohio. And after the meeting, a gentleman came up to me and he said, he said, my house burned down because the fire truck rolled on the road. I am aware of a case where two firefighters lost their lives in Blaine County, Idaho, because the roads were so bad. I'm not sure you can let the driveway be just anything. That's partly up to the fire department to decide what their level of comfort and utility is. But when it gets down to something that serves more than one home, and the need and pressure on this facility is greater, than I think what you've got here is really close. Like I said, I would make it 2 feet narrower, and still, I think, have it be adequate. But I'm hoping that the Planning Commission can see their way to say, hey, we've got pretty much the detail that we need here for this, and move forward. The alternative really is to just let somebody blade a road through the sagebrush. I think that's a pretty minimal definition of the town's responsibility. So I'll stop there and let other Planning Commission members pitch in.
Thanks, John. I totally agree with Lee. I think this is incredibly useful, and having something like this in our code would be helpful to everybody. So thank you for doing it.
Let me speak to the different. Lee has talked about this private streets versus public streets. This, I think, like I say, it's at the high end of what people have been building, but it's something that will stand up to the rainstorms we have. If it's a public street and the town is responsible for maintenance, there's several things that would need to be added to this. Every standard I've looked at requires compaction testing. Mm-hmm. That's very expensive in Boulder, but if it's going to be a public street where the town is going to be indefinitely responsible for maintenance, I think we'd have to be adding a requirement for third-party testing of the compaction. The road base probably should be a little thicker. Mm-hmm. The drainage crossings should meet a standard which is called H20. Which is basically a standard that's high enough that a fully loaded cement truck, a gravel truck, even a semi-trailer can drive on the road without crushing the culverts. So there are some things that would be required if it's going to be maintained at the town's expense in the future. We'd probably have to be a little stricter about the side drainage ditches and the culverts. As far as width, I could certainly buy Lee's argument that if it's a private street, we could be 10 feet wide. If it's a public street, it probably should be about 18 feet wide. Again, because you allow parking typically along public streets. So if a car is parked on one side, you still have one lane open. But those are the kind of details that we can work out as the time comes. Most standards, like for Kane County that I looked at, it runs 160 pages with drawings of everything from stop signs to fire hydrants to street lights. They don't codify them in the ordinance. The ordinance simply says we adopt the latest version of the Kane County Design Manual, which makes it much easier to change and update those drawings over time. So we could work out those details, but there are some, I would say this is probably a little on the low end of design if the town is going to be responsible for maintaining it indefinitely. But not all that.
Okay.
But not too much on the low end. And if it's going to be proposed as a new public street, then I think it's reasonable to ask that it be engineered, and an engineer will catch any unusual things that are necessary to deal with curves or bridges or culverts or whatever. I guess that I would want to step back from public to, do we want to make a distinction between private streets that only serve a handful of lots and private streets that serve more? Sort of like a mid-step in between public and private, because we all anticipate that subdivisions in Boulder, and we all, I think, kind of hope that subdivisions in Boulder are not going to be large. But there could be, another estates-type subdivision where the roads would be private. And if you're having that many units on it, I'm going to say that you want to go to an engineered road, whatever the engineer recommends above and beyond this. I'm also going to say that if a road is going to cross a stream or the floodplain, a wetland, or a slope that's 15% or greater, it needs to be engineered no matter how few homes it serves.
I'll agree with that. Any other comments? There is one thing that I was going to, you brought up that, is there, I kind of read it in the Forest Service standards, is that there, I guess I'm anxious about a number, a number where we actually, we've done a lot of numbers that haven't seemed to work in the past as far as when things become approach differently and standards raise and whatever. If, I see all of this going to the public in some kind of forum for comments, and I would like to know if we could actually have a standard that's based on something more concrete than a number that we come up with of our heads. How is a road affected by the number and speed of which a car goes? That there's those things, and if we kind of come up with a number that's based on the traffic level, as well as just how many dwellings. Like in yours, you say 8, correct? Mm-hmm. For the standard to change. And did you come up with that? How did you come up with that number?
That's a good question. That's a very fair question. And obviously, any number that we choose is going to be somewhat arbitrary. We normally figure that a dwelling, and people sometimes react to this, but most dwellings generate 9 or 10 trip-ins a day. And a trip-in is coming or going. So if you make a trip out and back, that's two trips. In Boulder, given that people have to drive to do absolutely everything in their lives, I wouldn't really be surprised if it's more than that. And the trip-ins have to count the UPS truck, mail, school bus, right? All those other trips that are not made by the individuals who might happen to live upon a road. And of course, they're also an average over time. So on Sunday, maybe it's six trips. It is arbitrary. You know, you can go find tables of studies that engineering firms have done over the last many decades of how many trips are generated. They find the apartments and attached dwellings generate more like 7 or 8 instead of 9 or 10. And in really big cities, the trip generation goes down a lot, but that's not applicable to Boulder. It's going to be your judgment in the final analysis. There's no way that I can give you science about this. I can only say that your judgment needs to consider the increasing impact of more and more use. And at some point, say what is enough use. I will also point out to you that given what I hear from everybody all the time in Boulder, that we don't really want large scale development. If you set the standard at 8 or 10, that's a significant disincentive to large scale development. And that might be what you want as a policy. It's a little bit indirect, but it's effective. And so, you know, that's why neither John nor I have put the full suburban urban standards out in front of this conversation, because we just don't even want to, we can rule those out without discussion. I picked 8 because I thought it was the fewest, and that's 80 trips a day, not very many. Thought it was the fewest that would make sense given the sizes of lots and the situations that I know about in Boulder. You could make that 10 or 12, you could make it 20. In the end, the reason the town appoints a planning commission is for you guys to exercise your judgment. And this is one of those cases where we can tell you what the consequences of a particular judgment are, but there's no real science to making that judgment in the first place. It's a matter of what you think is appropriate for you and your neighbors to live with.
Okay, so let's just talk about, okay, so if we did it at 8, that's 40 acre lot. That's a 40 acre parcel that would be divided. If we
at 1 to 5,
did it at 10, it would be 50, correct?
Mm-hmm.
So, I mean, that's kind
of a good
of
way of looking at it.
Anyway, that's the possibility.
Do we have any, do we know the history of the size of subdivisions that have typically been created in Boulder? I mean,
now, there's a list. What is it, Boulder King Estates, up to the north is the largest subdivision. And then there's a handful that might have 8 or 10 lots, but there aren't any really big subdivisions yet.
Correct, yeah. But there was one presented to us that would have gone up to 14.
Yep.
So
8 seems high to me.
Yeah. Years ago, that would have been 20 or more. If the LeBaron had
been over. Oh, wow.
In the Ox.
Yep. And I guess the one in the Peterson pasture was 14. Was that with Tom Hoyts? Was it, or was it 8?
What was that, Peg? 10? 8? That was 8 to 10.
I think 8 to 10. And there was some of those smaller lot sizes.
But that was clustering. That
right, right,
they
right.
Clustered there. So they right. were very small, half acre lots, yeah. too.
Okay. Can we just leave it then at 8 or 10 and as a presentation to go moving forward?
Yeah. Could I add a couple comments on that one, Tina? I think, you know, one thing to consider is Boulder King Estates is got, I think, 43 lots or something like that. About 20 of them are built up. That's up in the range where now it's it was pretty well deemed appropriate to chip seal that road. That goes up, a big step from the kind of sketch I had there. But that's also pretty typical throughout the state that when you start talking uses of around 100 vehicle trips a day, that's usually where you go from gravel roads to some type of asphalt-treated, chip-seal type surface. But Lee brought up a very important point. We've got two contradictory ideas here about subdivisions. On one, we want to promote affordable housing, which is my favorite topic. On the other hand, we want to probably have disincentives to a suburban type subdivision. So that's, we should keep those two contradictory goals in mind in this conversation of where do we, I do like the idea of tiering the road standards. I think it's necessary. And where we put it, maybe that balance between housing affordability and discouraging suburban subdivisions.
Okay, can I have I have another question? When someone is developing a subdivision and they want to do eight, say, and they choose to put two roads in, this devil's advocate, sorry. Mm-hmm. Does that mean that that's two subdivisions with four lots apiece? I mean, the road is on the same parcel, so therefore it is a considered one subdivision?
It's one subdivision, and the standards are ordinarily written to say that the road has to be X, whatever X is, based on how many units it serves. So if you imagine that I have 40 acres, I split it into 220s, and I put four lots around a road that leads out, let's say it goes out to Utah 12 to make this simple. So I have two roads going out to Utah 12. Well, neither of those roads serves eight lots, they just serve four. And so in your tiering, they would be covered by the standard for four lots.
Okay, so this is the road, what the road actually,
what the road actually carries.
Right, okay, great, thank you. John, did you have something? No.
No.
Okay, so are we clear on moving forward with this? Sorry, here we go, let me see where.
We're not necessarily making any big
decisions. We are not making decisions. We are
information.
So what I was saying is we're not making any big decisions tonight. We're just information gathering.
Right. And having some kind of focus to present as a possibility for our forum and for moving forward on this.
So. Right. Because the ultimate thing, too, right now is that we are going to hold the forum.
Correct.
And so we're trying to just tighten up our information a little bit for the town forum.
Right. So we can logically help the public
understand
why we would be doing what we're doing.
Right. And we were talking about doing streets, and was it zoning tonight? Was that the other thing? Mm-hmm. We were going to do two things or not?
Yep.
I think Lee actually has a presentation for
the standards or this one.
Zoning.
Zoning, yeah, for zoning.
I think of what we're doing is giving Lee some direction to draft some language that then would be the basis for having a public discussion on what we're proposing. Is that, do people agree with that?
Yes.
That's how I understand it. And there's a couple of things that need to be clarified based on our conversation here this evening that I will clarify, including we probably need to be more explicit about the connection between these road standards and the interface code. And then there's the thing that came up right at the beginning about trying to clarify that recorded access principle. I think I know how to tweak that a little bit and make it more clear. But I do have a slide presentation about zoning that we could do and then let people think about. I would like to say just one thing in between. You also got a memo or a paper from me talking about how all of this fits into the future subdivision ordinance that would have to be adopted to comply with Senate Bill 174. And what I said in there and what I want to say to you out loud is, you know, things are easy when you don't have any choices. And we have very few choices under 174. So I don't know that we need to spend a great deal of time, but a standard like this would fit in there. Peg is showing the list I had there, which is, hey, we need a statement of authority and purpose. We need some definitions. We need the procedures, which, given the nature of the guidance from the legislature, really are just going to be, we have to make a couple of choices that the state law presents. But basically, it's going to be reading the statute, showing what choices you all decided to make. And then the standards, and I wanted to point out that for water, wastewater, stormwater, any of those, the only way we can navigate SB 174 is to rely on the district health department or the state. The fire authority has to get involved in here to deal with the wildland interface code. We have to deal with the irrigation system and make sure a subdivision does not adversely affect it. If the subdivision has access to Utah 12, then you get UDOT involved in there. And then you have, or you could also ask that the subdivider indicate that people can get power on this day of being off the grid. I'm not even sure that's necessary, but it shows up in a lot of subdivision ordinances. And so then if you can go on down, Peg, there's three things that the town is ultimately responsible for. Everything else is going to depend on a determination by somebody else that the town just sums up. One is, does it comply with the wildland interface code? At some point, if it's big enough, I think that needs to be looked at by perhaps someone other than the fire department, but that's up to the fire department to say. Access, again, if we tier it, at some point it'll be looked at by engineers, but it's say eight or fewer or wherever that final number ends up, there'll be a town standard that looks a lot like John's drawing. That we can use. And then zoning, which we can move on to next if people still think there's time. The zoning is really where this is going to happen, because the town's going to have less than a month to deal with the subdivision application, unless the subdivider, you know, once an application is complete, unless the subdivider screws something up or wants to change something, then it's got to be done within 15 days. You communicate with the subdivider, you got 20 more. You can do rounds of that, but as long as their engineers agree with whoever's representing the town, those rounds are pretty much unimportant. They would only happen if there was really a conflict about how something ought to be designed. So I don't want people to stress very much over compliance with Senate Bill 174, because all we can do is really straightforward, and most of what the town can do relies on other agencies to make a determination before the application is complete. And then you say, okay, it's approved, build it the way you said you'd build it, and there you go. That's what the legislature wants to have happen, wisely or not, and that's what we're going to have to make happen. So the big question for the quality of these projects is going to be answered by how the zoning ordinance looks, rather than by anything in the subdivision ordinance. Is everybody clear on that?
Yeah, I'm still getting my head around it, but thank you.
Yeah.
Well, it's hard to get your head around the legislature saying that they don't even want the town council to be involved, but that is what they said. Boom.
Lee, just to clarify, though, in our subdivision ordinance and what you've been working on here, we have the opportunity to create an application, you know, a complete application. I mean, this is, mm-hmm. you know, the details with standards and checklists and so on. I mean, that's yes. our sort of way to manage what we want, as well as, you know, what we're going to allow in the zoning code. But it is that notion of a complete application that would be required of any applicant.
That's absolutely right. And I want to pick up one more thing that I said and what I wrote for y'all. There's going to be a lot of pressure on the zoning administrator.
Yeah, I saw that in there. Do we have an administrative land use authority? I mean, SB 174 keeps talking about, you know, you have to designate an administrative land use authority.
I think that's the
administrator. Yeah. Is it the zoning administrator or is it the site commission?
I mean, that could, it's like an appeal authority. You could designate the zoning administrator as your zoning administrative zoning authority. I'm stepping out here, Mike. I'm assuming that's what they did before with the appeal authority.
That's, yeah. And that's the zoning administrator and maybe one planning commissioner
it's to be determined.
Well, right. It says it can be staff or the planning commission or a subset of the planning commission. So that's what this is, the compliance.
That's what the law says.
SB, that's what the law says.
And here it would make sense just to keep it with the zoning administrator, I would think. We just don't have a deep bench for a whole lot of positions. So
really, you don't have a deep bench and you don't have much time. So I think you're going to have to say that the ALUA, what does that mean? Authorized land use authority, right? The ALUA is going to be the zoning administrator. And whoever that person is going to have, given that they are part-time and only so well compensated, are going to have a lot of pressure on them, which is somewhat mitigated by the fact that they can rely on district health or the state or UDOT or whomever. Right, that's some mitigation. I would encourage you to assign a planning commission member to be on call, you know, and somebody takes it in December, somebody else takes it in January, whatever. And so the zoning administrator could call that person that month and say, look, I have an application that I would like you to help me look at, so that there are two sets of eyes on it. Trying to do more than that within the time frame that's allowed gets you into all sorts of notice requirements. They didn't change the notice requirements about anything, right? And publication requirements and posting, and you can't do it through a normal planning commission process. And that pretty clearly was their intent, is that you can't do it through a normal planning commission process. If the best you can do, in my opinion, is rely on the other agencies to the extent possible and have a planning commission member, or it could be two, because that's not a quorum, sit with the zoning administrator to look at the thing and say, okay, are we good here? And you're going to have to absolutely, without exception, insist on the application being complete. That's the bottom line. If the application isn't complete, you don't have time to fix it.
Yeah. Great. Thanks. I appreciate you going through that, because that was one of the things I was thinking we really needed to hit. Okay.
I've cleared the decks. Lee, if you had some slides to present or something, or
I would like to go through this once, knowing that we'll have to go through it more than once.
Is that what
and
you
not
want?
Really, yeah. Not really have a ton of discussion because it's getting late, but let me get to where I can share the screen here. And let's see, more share screen. Share. Okay, are people seeing the slides?
Yes.
Okay. Some of you have all seen some of these slides before, several months ago. In talking about the questions that need to be answered, for the town to fulfill its goals of protecting critical open space and encouraging attainable housing. And to make this, make this concrete, it's easiest to talk about a specific parcel of land. And so I used an example that is actually pretty similar to a parcel that you have been approached about the development of in Boulder. I made it nice and rectangular and simpler than it really is for the purposes of this conversation. But this is something that really could happen in Boulder on a 60-acre parcel. And what makes a difference in what's possible? Well, there's already a dwelling unit on this parcel, so that's a fact. 60% or so of the parcel is irrigated. That's a fact. The shape in this case is that it's relatively long and narrow, and different shapes are easier or harder to develop. Long and narrow is not too bad. Access to the parcel, in order to make this really clear and simple, I decided that it had to be on a public road and we wouldn't talk about all those legal access issues. And then the final thing that you talk about is what are the rules existing and what they might be. And I think for the purposes of this conversation, it's really important to notice that the rules can vary by zoning district, which they don't really in Boulder right now, but they can. So let's say that we develop the 60 acres under the current rule, which is a minimum 5-acre lot size. 60 divided by 5 is 12. The existing unit counts as one, so you're creating 11 lots, actually creating 12 lots because the existing home will be on one of them. So you're creating the potential for 11 new homes lined up along this road. Given the way the owner is compelled to work, if they want to create that many lots, you're going to be subdividing the entire 60 acres, including all the irrigated. So let's talk about the consequences of that. Development under the current rules, there will be 12 driveways out onto the road, and that means 12 culverts. There will be 12 dwellings, one of which exists. 8 of them are probably going to be affected, and there's wastewater disposal, particularly probably going to be affected by the high water table that is created by irrigation. And so this district health might have something to say about that. We don't know. Are these going to be attainable for people to buy a new home and develop the driveway and everything on 5 acres? Probably not. The irrigated land is cut into 8 pieces, and you then have to ask, well, how do I manage that 36 or so acres of irrigated pasture effectively if I have 8 sets of fences, a bunch of culverts, the potential for people who are not very good about managing weeds, the potential for homeowners who are second homeowners who don't care about either the weeds or the productivity of the land? The answer, and this is borne out in rural subdivisions all over North America, the answer is that your ag productivity is going to plummet, possibly down to zero eventually, but certainly going to plummet. Let's see, where am I going here? So the question then is there a better way to do this? And of course, I've got some problems here because I can't use the slides at full size, but the question here is really define better. And the way the general plan defines better is that we would continue Boulder's agricultural heritage and we would encourage housing that is attainably affordable. Two pretty simple definitions of better. There could be more detailed ones, but I'm just going to focus on those two things. So what if we change the rules where the density of development that is permitted drifts? And it all drifts down to the non-irrigated end. And those 12 units suddenly appear on the roughly 24 acres that is not irrigated. That takes care of a lot of the drawbacks of dividing this parcel. And you have sent the ability to average lot sizes to the council, which is what's necessary to make that happen. So, you know, we get some questions about how you do that, how you set the density free. How big does the incentive have to be, if any, given the size, shape, and character of the parcel and what the developer, the landowner can actually do? Do you have to protect 100% of the open space in order to be allowed to slide that density down to the 24 acres? Or could there be a sliding scale? There are in many communities. What's the smallest acceptable minimum lot size? And what you sent to the town council indicated that we could go down to probably the lowest that Southwest Health will allow, which is about an acre. And then beyond that, how much of an incentive would you have to make some of those units affordable? There is also the question, the very interesting question, and to my mind, in Boulder, very important question, is whether or not you can allow density to drift from one parcel to another. We call that the transfer of development rights. And there are people in Boulder who own multiple parcels of land who could conceivably transfer density lots off of an irrigated patch onto a dry patch. You're not going to, in most scenarios, people do not require this to happen, but they allow the possibility so that landowners have the most flexibility. And then the second step is, okay, suppose that I have a parcel and Colleen has a parcel. Can we make a deal? And I can move the lots that are permitted on the irrigated or steep or scenic part of my parcel onto her parcel, which is more developable. Is that okay? Is that type of transfer okay? It could obviously work in both the community's interest and a landowner's interest to permit this. These transfers take a little paperwork to do, a little more than Boulder is accustomed to managing, but they certainly are not impossible, and there's certainly plenty of examples about how people do this. So here's my little drawing of, okay, if we have a person who wants to move off of the irrigated on their 60 and they own a 20 somewhere else that's developable, can they do that? Would we give them an incentive to protect that ag land? These are questions that you can answer, and there are details like how big does an incentive has to be. So let's say that the old cluster provision, which no one has ever used and no one ever will, given the way it's written, allows 2.5 acre lots. If at least half of the open space, which I'm going to say is usually ag land, irrigated ag land in Boulder, is protected. So if you start there, the incentive would get you at 2.5 acre lots. On that 36 acres of irrigated, you'd get 14.4 lots. And then on the remaining non-irrigated, you'd get the 4.8 that you get anyway, for a total of 19.2 lots. We round down in zoning, so 19. And is 19 more than half, again, more than the 12, enough of an incentive to get the owner to protect that ag land? That's a question the Planning Commission needs to discuss. And then how many of those 19 lots would you ask to be attainable in order to permit the transfer? You don't have to ask for any, but this is a point where you have leverage to say, okay, maybe we can get attainable housing here. And the thing I want to point out to you is that this is all market-based. We are imposing less on landowners. It's more complicated, but we are imposing less strict limitations on landowners than the existing 5 acre minimum lot size does. And then you could take this on up and say, well, do we need to have a bigger incentive? What if we gave them 22 instead of 12? That's almost double the original allocation of lots. And again, how many of those need to be attainable in order to qualify for the incentive? What you have here is the power to work with a landowner and that person's understanding and plan for what they want to accomplish, both physically on the land and financially, and have both the town and the landowner be better able to meet their goals than in the current system. So I'm going to...
I have a question here.
Yeah, can I do this one slide and then take the question?
Okay, sure.
So each parcel's different. So there's many variations on this theme as there are parcels. You can't do this without having lot size averaging, which you have already sent on to town council and which hopefully they will decide to adopt. The controlling factor of how much density you can add is the smallest acceptable minimum lot size. What we've been talking about and there probably needs to be more discussion of that, or there could be, is 1 acre. But really, it isn't 1 acre. It's whatever District Health will allow. And then the question is, how much of an incentive has to be, how much attainable housing would they have to provide in order to qualify for the incentive? 20%, more than that. Those are all questions that we have to answer to make this thing work. So let's stop there and take questions this far before we move on into this is all stuff that you guys saw in one form or another. It's been expanded some. We're going to go into a new step, but let's take questions here.
Actually, Lee, this is Peg. I had a question. I'm curious mm-hmm. how you see this working. Let's just assume that such a density drift arrangement got passed on and became part of the art ordinance. But how would you realistically see this conversation take place in light of SB 174? Would that happen like someone calls the zoning administrator and says, I have a plan, and that person says, well, let's sit down and talk about your plan and there? Or when does this
your subdivision plan, in order to be complete, has to show what you propose, right? So before the zoning administrator ever finds that an application is complete, this conversation will have to have happened. And there are a couple of ways, we'll get to this, but there are a couple of ways to set this up. And in both cases, there could be a conversation with the Planning Commission about this that comes before the subdivision, the plat, and the complete application is ever presented. And if a developer wanted to ignore that possibility, they could submit an application and see what happens. Presumably, the zoning administrator would say, well, this doesn't comply with the zoning. It's not a complete application. And you'd go back through the circle. But your question is a great one because it points out the reality here. Under the old ordinance, or a better version of the old ordinance, this could have been a conversation that went on through a public hearing and with the Planning Commission about the subdivision, right? That's how you would have done it. That's how I would still prefer to do it, but we don't have, our preferences are irrelevant. So now it all has to be handled at the zoning level, and the ZA is going to, you know, talk to a person and say, well, if this is what you intend to do, and we'll talk about the legal mechanisms that the town would use here in just a second. If this is what you want to do, here's what you have to do, which in either case boils down to a conversation with the Planning Commission that has to happen before you submit a subdivision plan. Hmm. Is that clear enough?
Yeah, because I thought we could no longer require like a concept plan or that kind of thing.
This isn't going to be a concept plan. And I think maybe let's move on and let me explain why, okay?
Okay, yeah.
Okay, because I intend to answer your question more okay. fully. So...
Mark had a question in the chat.
Yeah, I'd like to go
in the chat.
Let me just look at.
Go on, Lee.
Okay. So whatever the answers are to all those questions that I just laid out for you, which probably seem more overwhelming than they really are, the answers will be established and managed in your zoning. And that means they're going to be managed zoning district by zoning district. So we get to a couple of questions here. And the first one is whether or not using zoning districts that were copied years ago from some suburb make any sense in Boulder. Could, but I think that's a question. Right now is the time to ask and answer that question. And I'm going to go through some logic here. Right now, we have these zoning districts. Everyone is at least a little bit familiar. We have a C zoning district, of which there are some existing mapped areas. That was superseded by the performance standards that were adopted a couple of years ago. There is one spot of high density residential. Everyone knows where that is. There is medium density residential, which is what I think of as the village center, and which the most important thing about is probably that it includes lots of other uses besides residential. And it also includes a fair number of non-conformingly small lots. There is the low-density residential district, which in truth is not used for very much of the town. And then finally, 90% plus of Boulder is in the Greenbelt multiple use zoning district, which is very big and incorporates very different situations out there on the landscape. So here is a blow up of the middle of Boulder zoning map. And I was looking at this closely this afternoon when I clipped this out and put it together to see, okay, these are the areas that are zoned either low density or medium density, right? The low density is the pinkish, the medium density is the orangish, the red is commercial. So you've got Boulder Mountain Lodge there and so on. But then if you look over onto Lower Boulder Road, you see subdivisions which have exactly the same size and type of lots that are zoned low density residential over here that are not zoned low density residential down there. And I'm not saying that can't be, but it does raise the question of what's fair, and even more so than what's fair in this, just what's accurate. What is the zoning doing if these lots and these lots, which are all allowed to be 5 acre, one unit with an ADU lots, why are they in different zoning districts? That's a question you need to think about. Okay. So let's take another shot at this, which if I had shown up in Boulder years ago and you had said, let's do a plan, is the shot that I would have taken. So this is functional Boulder. And it's divided into several pieces, and you all may want to change the way I have divided it, and that would be great. But the way I see Boulder is that there's a middle, and in that middle, there are mixed parcel sizes that are near the center of things. They're mostly within the old town site plat that was created by the Forest Service, and that includes those roads that John referred to that haven't been opened. It includes most of the commercial, though not all of it, in Boulder. To the north, there is the area to the north, which has more trees, more topographic variation, and therefore it's easier to screen development from view. It has a lot of agriculture going on up there, and it mostly has pretty easy access to Utah 12. To the east of the center, there is a smallish area of mixed parcel sizes. There's a fair number of non-conformingly small parcels in there. They have access to the Burr Trail or other roads, not to Utah 12. To the west, there is a similar area that has a few larger parcels, and that is mostly distinguished by the fact that it has access to Utah 12, pretty easy access for most of those parcels to Utah 12. And then there is finally the famous Lower Boulder, which is where we seem to have most of our conversations, which is very wide open, views all the way across the entire valley there from one ridge to the other. It has a lot of agriculture going on, and we all know that it has access issues, both legal and physical. Getting a map promulgated will remedy a few of the legal issues, and if the council used the power state law gives them to declare roads that have been in public use roads, you could expand that map in the Lower Boulder area and make things even more clear. But that's the way I see Boulder as a professional planner and somebody who thinks about these issues all the time, is that you've got five different areas, and they all have a different character for various reasons. So I want to do this. There would still be a C commercial district for those existing uses, like, say, Hills and Hollows. You would still use the performance standards for commercial, but maybe with a twist here. You would leave the high-density residential where it is, probably not using it in the future. You wouldn't permit transfers of density either in or out of it. The medium density, and this is using the current zoning ordinance, the current zones, then we'll see how it would change with those other potential districts. In the medium density residential, you would allow transfers of density both in, probably not out. There are smaller lots. It could be expanded into the lower density residential or vice versa. And in that area, which is a relatively small, compact area, it would make a lot of sense to incentivize attainable housing. At the public hearing that we had on things we presented to the council or did not present, as the case may be, a lot of people said that maybe they could live with the idea of duplexes in a limited part of the community. This would be that part. The low-density residential is going to get used more in the future, as you will see. You would allow transfers of density into it, but not out of it. You would allow averaging in some smaller lots, and you would provide incentives for attainable housing, maybe duplexes and maybe not. But by treating the zones this really systematic way, you're beginning to be able to do things that you haven't done before. Then finally, there's the GMU, which if I were to say we're going to use that existing gigantic zoning district, you would reduce the density to 1 unit to 40 acres with averaging so they could put small lots in there. Any future development, residential development, would be either by a zoning map amendment or using performance standards the way that we do with commercial. Either one of those two approaches allows there to be a conversation with the Planning Commission before a subdivision application is submitted. There are a couple of things to know about the difference, though. A zoning map amendment is fully discretionary on the part of the town, but you can't add conditions to a map amendment. The application of performance standards is ministerial, not fully discretionary. You're stuck with the standards you've got and stuck with how they apply to a specific site, but they can be conditional. Either way, a landowner who comes in and goes through this process would then have permission to subdivide. So let's talk about how it would look if we switched out of the zoning districts that you have now into a new set that are somewhat different, and I think more in keeping with the character of your place. Commercial would be the same, HDR would be the same. We would create a village center district that recognizes that there are a lot of uses in there besides residential, like a school, a town hall, a church, a fire hall, a transfer station, a store. You might run this up to include the state park. You would allow transfers of density into this to make it a center of activity, but not out. And it would make sense, in my mind, to allow duplexes or maybe even sneak in a fourplex in the village center. The highway edge, which would be to the west of the village center, would be somewhat mixed use, smaller lots, transfers in, but probably not out. Maybe duplexes, maybe not. The east edge would be smaller lots, transfers in, not out, and maybe duplexes. And this way, you're getting much more precise about how you deal with potentially different land uses. The lower boulder, upon reflection, I didn't start out to write this exactly this way, but as I was finishing up this afternoon, I think in lower boulder, you emphasize the existing agricultural character. You try not to add traffic to overstressed roads. I think down there, you keep the 5 acre minimum with lot size averaging, but you allow transfers out, not in, and you don't incentivize attainable housing down there where there's no good access. Upper boulder to the north, again, I think you want to emphasize agriculture. You keep the 5 acres with lot size averaging, but in that case, you would allow a density bonus for housing that is effectively screened by the terrain, in other words, pretty much invisible, and or the provision of attainable housing. And you would also allow transfers of density out to the village center. And so then it ends up looking like this with landscape-based zoning districts. The village center, the highway edge zoning district, the upper boulder zoning district, the east edge zoning district, and lower boulder zoning district. And that is a lot to absorb, but I'm going to throw in one little zinger here, which is, as I have watched rural communities, and as all of you in conversations with you have watched rural communities change, like, say, Springdale, not so far away, or Torrey, people's fear of change has, in fact, led to radical changes in those communities. That's the story. And it's the story all through rural America. You can find it in the Adirondacks just as easily as you find it in southern Utah. And with that, I know it's a lot of information, and I know we're going to have to go through this more than once, but it gets you started thinking. What do people think?
I love it. I have wanted, I've wanted to see how we could create things differently. And I mean, I just think this is an amazing start. Thank you, Lee.
Sure.
I agree. I think it's a great starting point for a discussion.
Anyone else?
Let's see. Where are we? Okay, so
you'll share this presentation with us, Lee, right?
Yes, Peg has it, I think. And if she doesn't, I will get it to her, probably not later tonight, but in the morning. And she will disseminate it to the commission. And I encourage you, I talked to Colleen this afternoon. I talk to John and Tina all the time. Any of you who have a thought or a question about that, the possibilities here, send me an email and we'll set up a time to have a call so that we can, answer your questions or share possibilities. But I'm happy to hear that at least some people are feeling okay about this. I think that really Boulder is a very special place, and sticking with old-fashioned suburban zoning isn't any better than sticking with old-fashioned suburban roads.
Hey, Lee.
Yeah.
It's Michael Wynn here. How are you?
Right. Hi, Michael.
Hey. I just wanted to let you know I've been receiving a couple of comments on the
chat
from the participants.
Right.
Yeah. And so my approach to this is not so much to weigh in as you're drafting or creating or discussing any ordinances. It's more to provide a final review, a legal analysis of whatever it is you propose as a final draft. I find that when you have too many attorneys in the room, you get too many opinions on how things should flow. And you're doing a fine job. You covered all the high points, everything that I would be concerned with. But for now, it's most important for me just to gain the foundation.
Right.
And in order to be able to contribute more meaningfully, once these get a little further down the line. And so I haven't said anything, and it's been purposefully, but I find that when and if I do have a question, you tend to answer it at some point as you proceed.
Well,
so
my offer to have conversations extends to you as well.
Yes, sir. And I do intend on giving you a call. I just want to let you know I'm staying out of the weeds on purpose,
right,
until we get to a point where, hey, I can weigh in on a final draft. But if anyone does have any questions for me about any of this, I'd love to be able to address them. If I don't know, which is often the case, I'll definitely be more than happy to go and do the research and get back to you as soon as I can.
I do have a
question. So, yes, ma'am.
Could you give a quick response to your needs on our last proposal or draft to the town council?
The density averaging.
I'm sorry.
Lot size averaging.
Just give you, just tell us where you're at, because we weren't all at that meeting.
Yeah, no problem. Like I said, I've read the proposed drafts. I've paid attention as to what you guys are trying to accomplish. Really, all I'm looking to do is see how and if these laws have been challenged, what the appellate courts have said in response, what some of the concerns are further down the road. It's not to where, how it's drafted or stylized. I'm more concerned with what are the challenges, how's the appellate courts responded, and what are some of the concerns that, legally speaking, we might pose as a risk later on. And so I intend on having my review done before the next public hearing. It's like I said, I did a cursory review of Utah case law. These laws are in effect, haven't been challenged, which is good. But yet at the same time, I'd feel more comfortable if somebody had challenged average lot sizing, not to say that it hasn't been around for, you know, the last 20 years or however long. I just want to know what our appellate courts say in response to this. The one concern I had, and I believe I mentioned it with the mayor and council, is that I need to further understand or better understand the mechanism for once a property has been subdivided according to the average lot size ordinance and no further partitioning is allowed, how are we going to enforce, or how is that going to be ensured when, not if, the next generation says, hey, I want to be able to participate in these creation of subdivisions. It feels sort of like an alienation on property ownership, which is inconsistent with property rights to some extent. So I just need to understand a little better as to how we're going to approach that. And I mean, that's down the road, obviously, but maybe we could talk a little bit about that at some point.
You could give me a call because I've done that.
Okay.
And understand what you do. I could.
I'm sure it's just a matter of recording and providing notice, and then the rules, restrictions, and covenants run with the land. And so, you know, our property owner, our new and subsequent property owners are going to be on blast. But I don't want them to come along and say, hey, look, these ordinances are trash. We want to be able to participate in this the same way our predecessors did. And they're going to, quite frankly.
Yeah,
just want to be able to offer up a defense as to what we're going to say in our position.
It's an absolutely legitimate question that needs to be answered.
And so that's the role I feel I provide. It's not so much to tell you how I feel about the ordinances or what I think about them or even drafting them to some extent. It's mostly just, you know, when and if the appellate courts look at this issue, look at this type of partitioning, what have they said about it? What have been the challenges and what has been the response? That's what I'm concerned about.
Yep.
Okay. Michael,
go ahead. I'm sorry.
Oh, yeah. Why don't you finish? And then, given that we've gone about 2 hours, we've certainly consumed our time tonight. My comment that I sent you in the chat was that when we were talking about access, at some point, we're going to need some very hard discussions with guidance from council on how to deal with a lot of these roads of uncertain status where there's clearly a presumptive easement, but it's never been adjudicated, or town roads that are partially on private property and so forth. But I think that's that's 2 hours on its own, with probably you having time to look at a list of questions and issues before we even talk on it. So.
Sure. That's a very nuanced answer. I promise right from the get go. Whether we're talking prescriptive easements or some other form of, some other form of agreement between landowners, I'm not entirely sure, but let's do talk about that as well. But I did want to tell you, Lee, a lot of what we've been dealing with over here in Wayne is that exact issue. When does a driveway become a private roadway? At which point does the county take over? If a new property owner takes possession, a lot of times they're under the presumption that we are set to maintain that road. We've already dealt with that a number of times, but it keeps reappearing. And I made it clear that somehow we need to let these new property owners know very distinctly that we're not responsible for maintaining their roads. And in addition to that, you know, the setbacks, the easements, and the widths of the roadways are something we're always talking about. So if you need any sort of ideas how to approach that, I deal with that on a regular basis.
Everybody else,
our statutory scheme is our statutory scheme is obviously different, but it has the same effect as to, you know, when do we get worried about a fire truck, and at what point are we concerned with an ambulance having access to these homes, whether they can turn around, whether it's a public safety issue, how many homes can we put on a shared roadway? These are all questions we grapple with over here. So appreciate it.
Great. Thank you.
That's good.
Well, I think at the next meeting, we're going to discuss the possibility of doing a forum, and I can see that we could probably do it on roads and your presentation, Lee. So let's just leave it at that, unless anybody else has any comments before the end is here.
So did you want to add the zoning discussion onto the next regular meeting? Is that or talk about it?
We would have to talk about it. Definitely. We need to get an agreement that that's going to go forward in our forum. But
well, I think that we should at our next meeting, or I don't know if we want to do it tonight, but set up another meeting. I think that this kind of information for right now should stay in these work meetings, because we have so much that we're trying to do in our regular meetings, at least for a couple of meetings until that's just my idea. And maybe we keep these discussions in our work meetings and plan another work meeting like next month or so. I mean, we talked about having more of these planning meetings as we go along in the next, like into the next year, as we are doing this, you know, all this new stuff.
I guess I'm encouraging us to actually get the public involved sooner than later. Oh, but yeah. So, and in a forum situation, it's a little easier to. And anyway,
I totally agree with that.
So, with our next meeting, can we just talk about when we might schedule a forum, like early December or something? Yeah. Or
okay. All right. Yeah.
So that we talk about that, and then keep this kind of, maybe have one more meeting before we have a forum.
Okay.
Yeah. Maybe even just one more meeting to talk a little bit more about this.
Okay. Yeah.
That's my opinion. I mean, right. That's all.
Great. So I will put that on the agenda then.
This is John. I really appreciate and support Colleen's comment. I think these work meetings, this has turned out to be an incredibly productive meeting. We've had some good discussion. You know, in the future work meetings, we can have, without calling it a formal public hearing, we certainly can combine these types of presentations and discussions with opportunities for public input as well. So we should be, but I think more work meetings are going to be needed. I'm going to emphasize, we have been working on that housekeeping ordinance since April pointed out the problem in February. It's now going to go to public hearing at the earliest in November. And we have basically a year from now for the town council to get a complete revision of our subdivision ordinance pass. So we are going to have to work on a pretty tight schedule and be making very rapid progress to get something to town council in a time that they can act on it before the end of 24. So yes, more work meetings.
Okay, thank you. And scheduling a work meeting, I think, should happen in our regular meeting. So we're all set there. All right. So this is our first work meeting. And we're going to have more. And I guess I need a motion to adjourn, maybe?
I move to adjourn.
Okay. Well, any objections?
I'll second that.
Okay. We're moved and seconded. Okay. Thanks.
Aye.
Okay. Thanks so much, everyone. Thanks, Lee. And thanks, Michael.
Thank you. Good night.
Thank you.
Good night.
Lee, I'll look for that. I'll look for that presentation that you either did send me or it's at home.
Right. And if you don't find it, oh, I'm muted.
No, I just heard you.
I mean, just the theater.
Okay.
Can't where I need to be. Yeah, I'll send it to you if you don't have it now.
Thank you. Yep. Good night.
Good night.
Thanks, Michael. You. Good night.
Yeah, it is. That's great.
Thanks, guys.
All right. I'm glad you guys were.